Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. So the big takeaway from the primetime hearing of the January 6th committee last night for me was really very simple and very well documented, that Donald Trump knew full well that there was a riot at the Capitol that day and that Mike Pence and others were in mortal danger, that people close to Trump, from Jared and Ivanka to Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham to Kevin McCarthy, asked him to call it off, and that he didn't just fail to do so. They made a big point of this. He didn't just fail to do so. He actively poured gasoline on the fire, knowing full well what was going on. And there was evidence that was shared last night for that. So we will replay some of the most dramatic and factually important clips from last night. And we'll start with something that was both very dramatic and new to me and new to the general public. This is the actual radio traffic, like walkie-talkie communication, among members of Mike Pence's Secret Service detail, who were afraid for their lives and his at a crucial moment after the Capitol was breached. Now, you won't make out every word in this, but you'll get the idea that they thought they might be trapped.
Oh, they can't keep the building. Hold.
Turn that door up.
If we're moving, we need to move now.
Copy.
If we lose any more time, we may lose the ability to leave. So if we're going to leave, we need to do it now.
They've gained access to the second floor, and I've got public about 5 feet from me down here below.
Okay, copy. They are on the second floor, moving in now. We may want to consider getting out and leaving now. Copy.
Will we encounter the people once we make our way?
Repeat.
Encounter any individuals if we made our way to the.
There's six officers between us and the people that are 5 to 10 feet away from me.
Stand by. I'm going down to evaluate.
Go ahead.
We have a clear shot if we move quickly. We got smoke downstairs set by unknown smoke set downstairs by the protesters.
Is that route compromised?
We have this. Is secure. However, we will bypass some protesters that are being contained. There is smoke, unknown what kind of smoke it is. Copy?
Clear. We're coming out now. All right. Make a way.
That was radio traffic from Vice President Mike Pence's security detail as the rioters were closing in on them. We will play more as we go, with help from Quinta Jurecic, fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a senior editor at Lawfare. She previously served as Lawfare's managing editor, appears on some of their podcasts, and was an editorial writer for The Washington Post. Hi, Quinta. Thanks for coming on to help lead us through another January 6th committee hearing. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Is the main importance of that radio traffic clip that, for anyone who still thinks this was ragtag protesters who got aimlessly into the Capitol on a lark, that no, Pence and the members of Congress were in real danger from people who were specifically coming after them?
I think that's right. I mean, listening to that audio is really chilling. It was last night, and it was again when you played it just now. You can really hear, you know, these are professionals, but I think you can hear the fear and alarm in their voices. One thing that was said at the hearing last night, this is a quote from an anonymous White House staffer or former White House staffer who testified about what they were hearing at the time, that they heard audio of members of Pence's security detail using that radio line to call their families to say goodbye because they thought they very well might die at the hands of the rioters. And I think that's something that really makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck and brings home, as you say, you know, this was not a few protesters. These were not people who came in to give the police hugs and kisses, as Trump himself said. You know, this was a situation where trained security professionals thought that they might be killed, and that's a very serious thing.
So do you know the exact time of that radio communication? They showed footage of Pence being evacuated at 2:26, and I'll explain why that time is important in a minute. So would that anxious radio exchange have been a little before that?
I believe that's correct. I'm looking at my notes right now, and it seems, I think, that those calls, that audio was around 2:24 p.m. And we know that because it's linked to a message we saw from chat logs between White House National Security Council staffers saying that the Pence's security detail, and I quote, does not sound good right now.
So that was going on at 2:24, which is the exact moment when Trump sent a tweet that was described last night as pouring gasoline on the fire. The Trump tweet said, I'm going to read it, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done to protect our country and our Constitution, giving states a chance to certify a corrected set of facts, not the fraudulent or inaccurate ones which they were asked to previously certify. USA demands the truth. And the key part of that, of course, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done. And that tweet was a defining moment for one of the two in-person witnesses last night. It was Sarah Matthews, who on that day was Trump's deputy press secretary and who decided to resign because of that tweet. Here she is saying it herself.
So it was obvious that the situation at the Capitol was violent and escalating quickly. And so I thought that the tweet about the vice president was the last thing that was needed in that moment. And I remember thinking that this was going to be bad for him to tweet this because it was essentially him giving the green light to these people, telling them that what they were doing at the steps of the Capitol and entering the Capitol was okay, that they were justified in their anger. And he shouldn't have been doing that. He should have been telling these people to go home and to leave and to condemn the violence that we were seeing. And I'm someone who has worked with him. You know, I worked on the campaign, traveled all around the country, going to countless rallies with him, and I've seen the impact that his words have on his supporters. They truly latch on to every word and every tweet that he says, and so I think that in that moment, for him to tweet out the message about Mike Pence, it was him pouring gasoline on the fire and making it much worse.
Sarah Matthews, who was Trump's deputy press secretary on January 6th, and Quinta, the end of that was really interesting to me, and I think important, and hasn't getting enough replay this morning in the shorter versions of that clip that people are using. She described there from her experience why she thought something as simple as that one tweet from Trump at 2:24 might lead to more actual violence, because in her experience with Trump at campaign rallies, people hang on and react to his words and his tweets.
I think that's absolutely right. And it's a point that the committee, I think, really did an excellent job driving home. They played at near the end of the hearing testimony from a witness at a previous hearing. A person who was a Trump supporter came to the Capitol that day and who testified, you know, that when Trump tweeted that everyone should go home much later in the day, around, I think, 4 p.m., people really responded to that and left. And he testified, you know, if Trump had said that sooner, they likely would have left, that they were really listening to what the president was saying. I think another example of that, another really chilling example of that in this hearing, was audio that the committee played from, I believe, walkie-talkie communications between members of the Oath Keepers, the extremist group, a number of members of whom have been indicted for seditious conspiracy in connection with the insurrection. They played audio after Trump said another tweet at some point in the afternoon saying, please support our Capitol Police. And there's audio of an Oath Keeper saying he didn't say not to do anything to the congressman, and yeah, then laughing. And I found that incredibly striking because it's really an example of how, you know, that this is a person who is capable of kind of reading between the lines of what Trump does and doesn't say and saying, you know what, I'm going to keep going here.
And his supporters know what he means, and whatever code is embedded in there, certainly his most extreme supporters, as those clips of members of the Oath Keepers exemplify. So let me read those tweets, because that's worth drilling down on even a little Further, I read the 2:24 p.m. tweet saying Mike Pence didn't have the courage. People around Trump are urging him to say something to quell the violence. And so these two other tweets come between around 2:30 and 3:15 that do not ask them to leave the Capitol, but do ask them to remain peaceful. The first one says, please support our Capitol police and law enforcement. They are truly on the side of our country. Stay peaceful. So what you were just saying, Quinta, based on the clip of the Oath Keepers that they played, I don't have the audio of that one this morning, is that that was interpreted as leave the Capitol Police alone, because some of those people were getting injured, but you don't have to leave the members of Congress or Mike Pence alone.
That certainly seems to be how it was interpreted. And of course, we can't know, you know, how Trump meant it. But the committee, I thought, did a really striking job in presenting how through this time period before, you know, from about 1 p.m. to 4 p.m., Trump is being begged essentially by everybody in the Oval Office, in the administration, please, please, please call these people off. And he sends these tweets that sort of variously egg them on and saying, you know, Mike Pence didn't do enough, or kind of hedge a little bit. And that it certainly seems from that audio that at least some members of the crowd were not fooled or not willing to read that extra little bit into his tweets to say, OK, maybe we should back down, that he was successful in communicating, you know, with a wink and a nod that he did not want the violence to end.
And the second tweet in that set of two, a little after 3 p.m., said, I am asking for everyone at the U.S. Capitol to remain peaceful. No violence. This one is a little more unequivocal. Remember, we are the party of law and order. Respect the law and our great men and women in blue. Thank you. So again, he didn't say specifically, don't hurt the Congress people, don't hurt Mike Pence. He only named the, quote, great men and women in blue. But he did say, remain peaceful, no violence. And yet, people testified who are close to Trump that they told Trump that those tweets weren't enough. Why was that?
I think the reasoning is, you know, that there needed to be a strong condemnation. I was very struck by a video the committee played from deposition testimony by White House counsel Pat Cipollone, which was recorded only the other week when Cipollone finally came before the committee to testify, where Cipollone said essentially as soon as he saw that there was violence at the Capitol, I think he said around 2 p.m., he was immediately saying, we need to come out, we need to make a public statement, we need to say that this has to end and that people need to go home. And I believe in Cipollone's testimony, you know, there were a number of other people who were making the same arguments, practically everybody. And yet instead what you get is, you know, these kind of hedging tweets that ultimately do very little. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, during this period, according to the committee, Trump is sitting in the White House dining room watching Fox News, and he's calling members of Congress to try to further delay the vote certification. They reminded us, and this is something we'd already known, that he called, for example, Senator Tommy Tuberville, encouraging him to delay the vote certification. This is while the Capitol is under attack. And Tuberville said on television that he had to end the call because he had to evacuate.
Right.
So it's a very, very vivid demonstration of how during this period when everyone in the White House is essentially begging Trump to make a public statement and call this off, he is either, you know, pouring gasoline on the fire, as Sarah Matthews said, kind of sending these hedging tweets where you can read between the lines to say he's not telling them to go home, and calling members of Congress to try to, you know, further prevent the certification of the vote, which is exactly what the rioters are doing.
Listeners, any thoughts or questions on last night's hearing or the whole set of them so far or what might come next? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer with Quinta Jurecic from Lawfare and the Brookings Institution. So before we play a clip of Jared Kushner, which exemplifies what you were just saying about almost everybody close to Trump urging him to call it off and him not doing it, I'd like to address the motive here for a minute. And you kind of touched on it, but, you know, Trump's goal in egging on the violent mob, and you tell me if you think I'm close to understanding it. He didn't have the firepower to literally overthrow the U.S. government by force like a full-fledged military coup. So it looks like he was trying to use the mob to delay the congressional proceeding to accept the state's electors, to make it impossible to complete that process at that time, not just protest it outside, but use the mob to force a delay. And that would buy him time to convince Pence and more senators to vote to reject the electors and convince more state legislatures and governors to then declare that Trump won their states, not Biden. So it was all just to block Congress from finishing the task that day, to buy him more time for the parliamentary part of the coup. Is that anything like your understanding of why he wanted enough violence at the Capitol to run Pence and everyone out of there?
I think that's right. I might even go a little further and say that he was excited about the violence, was enthusiastic about it because he thought it would be effective in intimidating members of Congress to vote against the certification of the vote. So it wasn't just a question of, you know, delaying matters as long as possible, because I think it's important to remember this. Once the electoral vote is certified, it's done, essentially, that there are no further avenues. Now, there weren't really avenues at that point either, but that was sort of his very last Hail Mary hope. And so he's essentially pushing that off as long as possible. But I think it's also true that, you know, he's using that time to call around, try to get folks to vote against certification, but he is also using the mob as a tool to intimidate Mike Pence, to intimidate members of Congress. The committee played audio of one member of Congress relaying a conversation that happened between Trump and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, where McCarthy was hiding at this point, telling Trump, "You need to call this off. You know, my staff is running and hiding." And according to this Republican member of Congress, what Trump said was, "Well, Kevin, I guess they're just more upset about the election than you are." Right. And I think you can certainly read that as a form of a threat. You know, do not certify.
Certainly taking the side of the rioters over the side of House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and his concerns about his own safety and his staff's safety. But when you say intimidate McCarthy, intimidate Pence, intimidate other members of Congress, do you mean because he was trying to get them to fear for their physical safety? Because that's a real fascist thing, right? And we have to use the word fascist here sometimes, even though it's an extreme word, because it applies to things like using street mobs, you know, like in fascist Italy once upon a time, to try to enforce the will of the authoritarian leader. Do you mean intimidate physically to try to get Kevin McCarthy or anyone else afraid for their physical safety, so they change how they would vote on certification?
So I want to be careful here, because of course we don't know, you know, exactly what was going through Trump's mind. I would say I think it is the committee has made the case that yes, that part of the effect certainly of Trump's actions was to create an environment in which members of Congress were intimidated, and that therefore that they would not vote to certify the election, and that Pence would be intimidated because, you know, these are people who are calling for him to be hanged. And Trump is egging them on, that they would be intimidated. And so I think that, you know, the question of whether that constitutes fascism is a complicated one. You know, it's a definition that many an academic has argued over for a very long time. But I do think that, you know, you're getting to something real when you point out that this is an example of a charismatic leader ginning up a mob and using extra legal violence in service of personal aims. And that's a very frightening thing.
So all these people in Trump's inner circle are urging him to call off the rioters, but instead he egged them on with a 224 tweet. There were many examples last night of people urging Trump to call it off. Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham from Fox, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, White House Counsel Pat Cipollone, Don Jr., Jared and Ivanka. Here's just one example of that, and it's a clip they played last night of son-in-law Jared Kushner after House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy had called Jared from the Capitol and said he was scared.
Heard my phone ringing, turned the shower off, saw it was Leader McCarthy, who I had a good relationship with. He told me it was getting really ugly over at the Capitol and said, please, you know, anything you could do to help, I would appreciate it. I don't recall specific asks, just anything you could do. Again, I got the sense that, you know, they were scared.
They meaning Leader McCarthy and people on the Hill because of the violence?
That he was scared, yes.
The Leader McCarthy was scared, Jared Kushner there. And Quinta, one of the things that was described last night was that McCarthy tried to get Trump himself to call it off, and Trump seemed unresponsive. I guess they had that exchange that you were just describing where Trump said maybe they're more concerned about the election than you are. But after that, McCarthy then resorted to appealing to Trump's kids and called Jared, the son-in-law. So put that in context for us. And in addition to all those other names I mentioned who were trying to get him to call it off and he wouldn't, of how alone Trump was in deciding not to call it off. It seems like everyone who was everyone to him, except maybe Rudy Giuliani, who he called two times during the riot, was urging him to call it off, but he made the singular decision not to do so.
That's exactly right. And I mean, I think this goes to a point that the committee has really been driving home from moment one, you know, that this was not a situation from the beginning, right? From the beginning of the point where it became clear that Trump had lost, this was not a situation where he was being egged on by people around him in trying to overturn the election in the various forms that that took. This was a situation in which he was told repeatedly by everyone around him, you have lost. You need to stand down. This is not appropriate. We do not want to take this step. And he just continued forward on his own against the advice of everyone around him, as you say, with the exception of a few folks like Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, those kinds of people, but that those were really in the minority. And as you say, you know, Jared Kushner was pushing against this. We had some testimony about the role of Ivanka Trump, who was called in and was essentially trying to plead with her father to call this off, that, you know, she was, according to the committee, one of the people who was able to sort of finally convince him to say that people should leave. This is, you know, really a man who is alone in this effort. And I think that that's important because it makes clear that, you know, as Representative Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the committee, has said, you know, this is not a child. This is an adult man. He is making these decisions, and he is, in this case, swimming against the current of what everyone else wanted. He is the person who we should hold responsible here.
We'll continue in a minute with Quinta Jurecek from Lawfare and the Brookings Institution. We'll play more clips, including an outtake that they revealed from that 4:17 p.m. video that Trump finally did release, asking people to go home. But the outtake is so revealing. Also a clip of Steve Bannon going all the way back close to Election Day, kind of predicting this whole thing. And we'll take some of your calls. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with excerpts from and reactions to the January 6th committee primetime hearing last night and the whole big picture of that hearing in context with Quinta Jurecek from Lawfare and the Brookings Institution. Quinta, it's interesting to me as I look at our caller board, one of the threads that's developing is people having more sympathy or less sympathy for the witnesses who are testifying and revealing some of these facts last night. So let's take one of the callers who is not so sympathetic to these witnesses. Anne in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. During the testimony last night, I just kept asking myself, how can these people finally resign after all of what he has said and done over the course of his presidency from day one? I mean, they see that he's a bigoted, racist, horrible, violent man who wins at all costs. And if he doesn't win, he lies. I mean, especially the woman who sang with his press secretary saying, you know, she's traveling all over the country with him, going to his speeches. I mean, how can you stand there and listen to what is coming out of his mouth about the press, about women, about, you know, we all know. And she stood there and she thought, oh, gee whiz, I think this is great. And then this happens. We wouldn't be having this conversation if people had woken up in the very beginning and not voted for that man. And now we have his Supreme Court for a generation plus, and it's really heartbreaking. And so, I mean, I just hope, you know, the DOJ goes after him. That's all I can say. And I don't have any sympathy for these witnesses. I really don't. You know, wake up, folks.
And my attitude. Thank you very much. You know, it does raise the question, Quinta, of why was this the breaking point? Why was this the bottom line when Trump did all these other things that could be considered so egregious, some of which Anne from Brooklyn was just ticking off? Why was this the breaking point for somebody like Sarah Matthews last night, or for Attorney General William Barr, who enabled Trump, you know, on so many other egregious levels, as many people see it? Why just this?
Honestly, it's a great question. And while the questioner was talking, I was thinking of another incredible quote from the hearing last night from Eugene Scalia, who's the Secretary of Labor and under Trump, and the son of the former Supreme Court Justice, who sent a memo after the insurrection to Trump asking to convene a cabinet meeting. And one of the things that Secretary Scalia wrote was, and I'm quoting here, "I believe it is important to know that while president, you will no longer publicly question the election results. After Wednesday," so that's January 6th, "no one can deny this is harmful." So I think, you know, we might ask ourselves, really, was it only after Wednesday that it was clear that was harmful? And I do think that, look, that is a very real question. I have myself been puzzled by why people drew the line where they drew it. You know, this is something that had been happening from early in 2020, that Trump was questioning election results, trying to undermine the peaceful transfer of power. That said, however frustrating that might be to folks who are unsympathetic to these witnesses, I also think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, there is a certain power to the committee being able to say, we're having witnesses here who were sympathetic to Trump. You know, they are Republicans. They are fans of his policies in various ways. These are not, you know, bleeding heart liberals. And even they thought that this went way too far. And that's, I do really wonder whether that might be more convincing to some folks.
Yeah, that's really the whole point of the hearings, I think. And Liz Cheney said it out loud last night, reminding everybody that the whole list of witnesses over the various hearings this summer have not been Democrats or opponents of Trump, but people who were in Trump's inner circle as allies of Trump, and some who were just, you know, neutral Capitol law enforcement and things like that. But so many people who've been very close to Trump, and that gives them so much credibility, as it would in a court of law. You know, you mentioned one thing. 2016, he was talking about that elections would be considered stolen if he didn't win them. And here's a clip that they played last night of Steve Bannon going way back. I think this was just before Election Day. I'll have to double check that, or you can fact check me on this. But seeming to predict the whole thing.
And what Trump's going to do is just declare victory, right? He's going to declare victory. But that doesn't mean he's the winner. He's just going to say he's the winner.
The Democrats, more of our people vote early that count. Theirs voted mail. And so they're going to have a natural disadvantage, and Trump's going to take advantage of it. That's our strategy. He's going to declare himself a winner. So when you wake up Wednesday morning, it's going to be a firestorm. Also, if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. No, because he's going to sit right there and say they stole it.
Yeah, so that was, I've got it now, October 31st, 2020, so a few days before the election. And if some of that audio was a little garbled, Bannon was saying, so when you wake up Wednesday morning, the day after the election, it's going to be a firestorm. Also, if Trump is losing by 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's going to be even crazier. He's going to sit right there and say they stole it. So what Bannon pulls the curtain back on there is that they were planning this all along.
I think that's absolutely right. And it really makes clear that, you know, this was not something that was spur of the moment in any way. This was a plan. It took various manifestations as Trump tried, you know, various different avenues, from declaring himself the victor to attempting to interfere with the counting of the ballots to ultimately at the end of the day attempting to throw off the certification of the electoral vote through violence. But this was not, you know, the whims of somebody who wasn't really committed. This was, as you say, in some form or another, the plan from moment one.
Diego in Sunset Park with a little more sympathy for the witnesses, I think. Diego, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Well, really, I think the previous caller took my sentiments, because after like 4 or 5 years of outrageous tweets, the ones that implicated Mike Pence were the ones that took them over the line. But really, I mean, I respect your journalistic integrity, but they displayed exactly when he called off the dogs. It was after Fox News said that the military was coming and that the advantage was now with law enforcement that he made the tweet to go home. It wasn't until that point. So he was relentless, and nothing was going to stop him until the law enforcement took the upper hand against the rioters.
Yeah, that's another point that they made last night, Quinta. That's worth highlighting and spotlighting, right? At least the timing, and I guess it's an inference to be drawn, but Trump was resisting all these pleas from everybody to call off the rioters, and the time when he actually did it with that video in the 4 o'clock hour was after it was revealed to him that the National Guard had been called out and as many as 1,800 troops were on the way. Coincidence?
I certainly don't think so. I mean, the caller is absolutely right that it is very notable that Trump did not call things off when it seemed like he might potentially seize the day. Honestly, I think this goes to another question, which is why it took so long for the National Guard to be deployed in the first place. There's been a great deal of work by various congressional committees and inspectors general done into why that might have been the case. And it's a complicated story, but certainly one part of it is that, as the committee said, Trump did not take any action to make that happen. In fact, to the extent that anyone did, it was Vice President Mike Pence, who wasn't even in the chain of command. So not only is it not until that Fox News announces that the Guard is being deployed that Trump finally calls things off, but it took so long precisely because of Trump's own failure to act.
So then he gets to at least look like he's the one who called it off, rather than the National Guard has to come in effect for him via his people. So finally at 4:17, Trump releases a video asking the rioters to go home. He did repeat the big lie in that video. And another dramatic revelation last night, as we come to another clip, was the release of an outtake from his recording session of that video, in which he starts to say the election is over, but then edits that part out. Here's that.
But this election is now over. Congress has certified the results. I don't want to say the election's over. I just want to say Congress has certified the results without saying the election's over, okay?
So, Quinta, what's the significance to you of that distinction, saying Congress certified the results, but not saying the election is over?
It's incredibly striking because I believe this was a video that was recorded the next day on January 7th. You know, even then, Trump is...
Oh, so that was not... I don't want to misstate. So that was not for the 4:17 p.m. video. That was for a video the next day?
I believe that's correct. There were outtakes from both. But so even then, you know, he's essentially refusing to concede. He's refusing to, allow the peaceful transfer of power. And he's kind of, as we've talked about with folks, reading between the lines, allowing that possibility for folks to think that he might still potentially be the rightful president, even after everything that's happened.
By the way, credit where credit is due, the Steve Bannon clip from October 31st, 2020 that we played was obtained by Mother Jones, and the committee credited Mother Jones for that last night, and we should too, so there it is. And Trump issued one more tweet on January 6th, again something that maybe hasn't gotten enough attention, but that his deputy press secretary, Sarah Matthews, the witness last night, one of the witnesses, reacted strongly to. It was at 6:01 p.m. when it was all finally beginning to wind down. Trump tweeted this justification for and celebration, really, of the riot. Here's the tweet. He wrote, "These are the things and events that happen when a sacred landslide election victory is so unceremoniously and viciously stripped away from the great patriots who have been badly and unfairly treated for so long. Go home with love and in peace. Remember this day forever." 6:01 p.m. And here is Sarah Matthews from last night on how she reacted on January 6th to seeing that tweet, even though she was Trump's deputy press secretary.
At that point, I had already made the decision to resign, and this tweet just further cemented my decision. I thought that January 6, 2021 was one of the darkest days in our nation's history, and President Trump was treating it as a celebratory occasion with that tweet. And so it just further cemented my decision to resign.
Sarah Matthews, who again was Trump's deputy press secretary on January 6th, but decided to resign as that day became more outrageous to her. Quinta, that 6:01 p.m. tweet really sets up everything Trump has done since, right? He has stood by the riot all this time and only signals that his authoritarian, fascist, street mob kind of rule might return if he's elected again. Would you agree?
I think that's a very real risk. You know, there's certainly at the end of the day when Trump, you know, sends that tweet, there is absolutely no sense of remorse. You know, there is no sense that this is perhaps something that was wrong to do. He's sort of clinging on to an ability to kind of hold out himself as still the rightful president, to hold on to the loyalty of the people who committed that insurrection for him. And as you say, it's a very frightening thing, precisely because we've seen reports that he is planning to announce another run for president. And I think the committee has done a very good job in driving that point home. You know, this is not a bullet that was dodged, and that, you know, is, you know, we've survived, we've made it through, and now we're okay. This is an ongoing danger to American democracy.
Some tweets coming in on why this might have been the breaking point for people like Sarah Matthews. One person tweets, they realized that their own personal safety was on the line. Another one tweets, this was the breaking point because, in the words of Martin Niemöller, they came for me, from that famous quote. They came for these people and I didn't do anything. They came for those people and I didn't do anything. They weren't coming for me. Then finally, they came for me. So that's one theory. Here's a question on Twitter. Let me get back up to this. I haven't heard anyone discuss what would have happened if the rioters had harmed or even killed the vice president or a member of Congress. Was martial law the ultimate goal? It's a hypothetical, Quinta, but one that I have a feeling maybe you've thought about.
Well, so I think it's important to clarify what we mean by martial law. I think people, you know, often say that there's this idea that the president can kind of just declare that the military is now going to be in charge under the presidential rule. And that's not actually what martial law means. What martial law means is that the military comes to the aid of the civil authority. So it's sort of backwards in a way. I think that what we would have had in that situation would have been a constitutional crisis to an extent even more dire and immediate than we already had in a way on January 6th. I know that I believe Michael Fanone, one of the officers in the DC Police Department who was attacked that day and who has spoken a lot about his experience, said that he was afraid that, you know, what we might have been set up for is sort of an hours long siege situation of violence against members of Congress, against Vice President Pence, while law enforcement tried to clear the Capitol. And so to be clear, I don't think there was any world in which at the end of the day, Trump would have been, you know, lawfully the president of the United States, you know, under the Constitution on January 6th, on January 20th, the outgoing president is no longer the president. But there certainly could have been an enormous degree of chaos and violence, and the transition could have been even less peaceful than it already was. And I do think it's important to understand that, you know, for all of the violence and horror on January 6th and of the many people or the handful of people who died, both among law enforcement and of some of the folks who were rioting as well, it is truly astonishing that there was not more violence. I mean, I think in many ways we were let off extremely, extremely lightly. And to some extent, that's kind of helped Trump and his allies in their effort to downplay what happened.
I guess if we want to engage that hypothetical, maybe Trump would have, if Mike Pence was killed, installed somebody like Rudy Giuliani as vice president, and he would have tried to do what Pence refused to do, use what they were claiming was the power of the vice president to refuse the electors and send it back to the states, and then there really would have been a constitutional crisis. Janet in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janet.
Good morning. I've wondered, is Trump senile because he doesn't realize that he lost the election, or probably the more likely scenario is that he is just a great liar? But as I've traveled a little bit around the country, I've run into Trump supporters who are tired of Trump. And I think many people are tired of Trump. And I wonder about people, maybe like DeSantis, who have said, oh, this is how you can do it. This is how we can manipulate people. And that's what I'm really worried about for 2024, a skillful Trump imitator. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. You know, she raises this question that comes up, is he just that evil or is he crazy? And I don't know if they're necessarily mutually exclusive, Quinta, like he could be deluded, that kind of crazy, where he really didn't realize that he didn't win the election, but he also could be a psychopath, that kind of crazy, you know, where he knows full well what's going on, but he doesn't have the emotional capacity to care about anything but himself.
I think that, you know, this question of can we ever know what is happening inside Trump's head is certainly something that the committee has addressed throughout the hearings, because it gets to this question of criminal culpability that we, you know, how do we understand Trump's mens rea, his state of mind under the criminal law? And it's a difficult question for precisely the answer that the listener points out. You know, can we really know if he knew that he lost the election and didn't care and lied and forged forward anyway? Or could it be that he convinced himself that he won? I think that as the committee has put forward more evidence, it strikes me as harder and harder for Trump to argue that he had, you know, 100% deluded himself. But this is one of the questions that you get to, you know, when you're talking about someone who is as self-centered, let's say, unique in his psychology, perhaps, focused on his own advantage to the exclusion of everyone else, as was the former president. And, you know, there are a lot of different conclusions you can draw from that. But one thing that I think we can say quite clearly is that anyone for whom there is a question about, you know, did he know that he lost the election and he proceeded to incite a violent mob anyway, or was he simply delusional? That's not a person who should be the president of the United States.
Yeah. One more clip on the question, what happens as a result of all this evidence? Here's January 6th committee chairman Benny Thompson from last night.
Our democracy withstood the attack on January 6th. If there's no accountability for January 6th, for every part of this scheme, I fear that we will not overcome the ongoing threat to our democracy. There must be stiff consequences for those responsible.
There must be stiff consequences for those responsible. There must be accountability to save our democracy from this kind of ongoing threat. What does Benny Thompson have in mind as far as, you know, you can tell? I mean, didn't say, or what in your experience at Lawfare and the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution would you say that the committee is trying to set up here, even if they're not saying it in words?
I think that we can think about accountability in a number of different ways. You know, so one thing that there's been a lot of focus on is the question of criminal accountability, in the form of prosecutions by the Justice Department. And the committee is certainly interested in that as well. They've made very clear that they're sort of building a criminal case against Trump and that they're frustrated that the Justice Department hasn't taken action. That's one form of accountability. And I think it will be very interesting to see what actions the Justice Department takes in the coming months. But another way to understand accountability is, you know, moral and political accountability. Telling the story of the insurrection to the American people, making them understand how damaging it was, and sort of making sure that the people who were responsible for this, so not just Donald Trump, but also, for example, Senator Josh Hawley, who fist-pumped the rioters ahead of time, and whom the committee showed video of him running away from the insurrectionists once they make it into the building.
He fist-pumped the rioters from safely behind police lines.
Yes, exactly. And so that's a kind of accountability, too. It's not criminal accountability, but it's the committee saying you will not be able to run away from this. We will make you have to face this in your political career. And that is also a kind of accountability. Now, ideally, I think we would see a political accountability where the American people see this evidence and reject supporters of the insurrection in the upcoming midterms in the 2024 presidential election. I don't know if we will. I certainly hope that that is the case. If that doesn't happen, I don't think it will have been a failure on the committee's part, but it is something to keep in mind. And I think, you know, it is also something to keep in mind that the Justice Department is not the ultimate arbiter here, that those other forms of accountability, holding people to account, are of equal value as the criminal law.
Another listener tweets, I think January 6th was a breaking point for some staffers because they were afraid of the legal jeopardy they might have been in by staying. So another listener opinion on that. Quinta, 30 seconds. They surprised some people last night by announcing that there will be more hearings in September. They've spent the summer drawing out this timeline from just before the election until January 6th itself. What more do they have to do?
They've said repeatedly that, you know, they're continuing to receive new information, new testimony. So I think what we'll see is, you know, what else they have found in the interim between these hearings and within August. They've certainly been extremely impressive in their investigative work thus far. And so I'll definitely be watching to see what new they uncover about what happened between the 2020 election and January 6th.
Quinta Jurecic, fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a senior editor at Lawfare. She previously served as Lawfare's managing editor, appears on some of their podcasts, and was an editorial writer for the Washington Post. Thank you so much for your clarity and eloquence about all this.
Thank you for having me.